Sometimes it's good to introduce a chapter before we actually start to study it. This is what I'd like to do this morning with Revelation chapter 12. We finished up the 11th chapter. We're over halfway through the book. As we look at Revelation 12, we're going to find visions. And in Revelation 12, we have two visions. The first is going to be in verses 1 through 6. And John talks about a woman. He says this woman is pregnant. She's about ready to deliver a child. As we look at the information in verses 1 and 2. And this pregnant woman with her child coming into the world, the devil is going to try to destroy the child, as we'll see in verses 3 and 4. And because the devil wants to destroy this child, God takes it away. That's going to be in verse 5. And then we'll find that this woman, she flees in the wilderness, where she's protected by God for a period of time. After we've finished up with the first part of the chapter in Revelation 12, we turn to the second vision. This is going to be in verses 7 through 17. Here John talks about a war. He says that this war is in heaven, and this conflict causes Satan and his helpers to be cast down to the earth. We'll see this in verses 8 through 10. And the result of this is that righteousness begins to prevail, verse 11. But John says in verses 12 through 17 that the conflict isn't over. The conflict continues in a different place. From heaven it's moved down to the earth, but it still continues. So we've got, as we said before, a lot of information in the book of Revelation about the Christian era, the New Testament church, and this certainly is one of the things that we see here. We've got information as far as the ongoing struggle between good and evil, information about the church, and even some information about the Old Testament era that brings us up to the time of Christ and so forth. So a lot of things we've said before in the book of Revelation are said about Satan. This book really has a lot to say about him, and we'll see that in this particular chapter. One of the things to remember kind of from the outset is that we're going to see a period of time that we've seen before. John describes this in three different ways in the book of Revelation. He sometimes uses the number 3.5 to describe it. That, of course, would be a half of 7. 7 is perfection, completeness in the book of Revelation. So you take that number and you half it, you know, probably not so good. And he also uses 42 months or 1,260 days. So we've seen this expression before. John's going to use it again in this chapter to describe the fact that God's people are going to face hardship throughout time. Okay, looks like everybody is situated and ready to go. If your Bible's open to Revelation 12, let's read the first verse. And a great sign was seen in heaven, a woman arrayed with the sun and the moon under her feet, and upon her head a crown of 12 stars. We've made it clear at various times that when we read the Bible, we want to make sure that we pay attention to all the words. It would have been one thing if John had said there was a sign in heaven. But what's he say? Not just a sign. He says there's a great sign. So that's kind of a word which says pay special attention to what we're reading about in this particular chapter. This is very, very important. Then you also have some references to light, the sun and the moon. Well, these also would suggest that whatever we're talking about is very, very significant. Now, it's been a little while since we were there, but if you skip back across the page a bit, over to Revelation chapter 9, verses 1 and 2, we'll have some information here, I think, that'll help us understand what the lights are in Revelation 12. And the fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star from heaven fallen upon the earth, and there was given to him the key of the abyss. And then in verse 2, he opened the pit of the abyss, and there went up what? Smoke out of the pit, as the smoke of a great furnace. And what was darkened? The sun, light. You remember what we said as far as interpreting Revelation 9, 1 and 2? What was the light? God's word, truth, the information that we need. And what's the devil in the business of doing? Deception. All right, he wants to, that smoke, that's his point of emphasis. He wants to go ahead and cover that up, keep people from the truth and the light. Well, from what I can tell in Revelation 12, the image of light here has that same general sense. We're talking about information, we're talking about light, or we might say revelation from God. Then beginning in the middle of Revelation 12, verse 1, we have reference to a woman. Now, a lot of people, I'm not necessarily saying that this is your view, but a lot of people, when we see information about a child and there's a woman who's pregnant, what's the first thing that's going to pop into the mind? All right, a lot of people are going to think this is Mary, the mother of Jesus. I don't think so. And I don't think so for several reasons, one of which is for example, look down at verses 13 through 17. When the dragon saw that he was cast down to the earth, he persecuted the woman that brought forth the child. I don't know that the devil was really going to be after Mary. I mean, once she brings Jesus into the world, you know, why go after her? I mean, Jesus is the one that he's going to be after, right? So it really doesn't make a lot of sense to understand that as Mary. And we could, go on and continue to read verse 14. She's out there in the wilderness being nourished. So it really becomes a huge stretch to try to understand this as Mary. My proposal is going to be that this woman is a symbol, just like a lot of other things in the Bible. And not only is she a symbol, it seems to me that as we look at Scripture, we'll do that after a bit, or at least make some references, it seems to me that she symbolizes religion. And John uses her in two ways in this chapter, to symbolize some things associated with the Old Testament, as well as associate some things with the New Testament. Now let's pick up these two points and combine some passages with them. We've said, what about the light? It means what? All right, God's word, revelation, information from God. And now this woman, interpreted as religion from God. Let's go back and look at some passages. We'll pick up three readers here, two from the Old and one from the New Testament, so you have some time to get to these references. Isaiah 9, verses 6 and 7. Bonnie? All right, Scott, if you want to pick up Micah 5, verse 2. Micah 5, verse 2. And Steve, did you flash a hand? Okay. If you'll pick up from Luke 2, verses 25 and 38. Luke 2, 25 and 38. Now, we know that we have religion under the Old Testament. Everybody should be aware of that fact. And we've got 39 books about religion as far as the Old Testament is concerned. And then you've got the information about, you know, Adam and Abraham and people who lived prior to Moses' law. But let's see if these guys had any light. Let's start with the first reference, Isaiah chapter 9, verses 6 and 7.
Of the increase of his government and peace, there shall be no end. Upon the throne of David and upon his kingdom, to order it and to establish it with judgment and with justice from henceforth, even forever. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this.
Now, the people that first heard this information, they probably just kind of scratched their heads a bit. What does this mean? Go show up to the Bible study and this passage is read, and we really don't have much of a clue. But even though they didn't have maybe a real comprehensive understanding of it, they at least had the information. So there's some level, there's some degree of light there. Even early in the Bible, remember Genesis 3:15? You know, the promise about the serpent, the bruised head, and so forth. There was some light there. Once again, the people were kind of struggling a little bit with the details. What's he talking about? Well, something good's going to come down the pike. But we're not quite sure about all the details. So Genesis 3, we've got Isaiah 9, and there are tons of passages. Here's another one, Micah 5, verse 2. Okay, there's going to come forth a ruler. And he's going to be back there, the Ancient of Days. Well, how can that be? I think if we had lived under the Old Testament and heard this in the synagogue, we'd probably say, I can't understand that. But at least there's enough light there to know that somebody's going to come. And it's going to be a very special person. So we've got some understanding, but we just need some more information. Some more time has to pass. And then we get up to the time in Luke 2. And here's a description of what some people were beginning to think about in the first century. Steve, Luke 2, 25 and 38.
25 through 38?
No, those two verses, 25 and 38. We'll separate them, thank you.
And behold, there was a man in Jerusalem whose name was Simeon. This man was set in the crowd, waiting for the consulate of Israel, and the Holy Spirit was upon him. Verse 38. And coming in that instant, she gave thanks to the Lord and spoke to him, to all those who look for redemption.
Okay, both of those passages talk about people who were looking for something. Well, if you're going to look for something, do you have to have some knowledge? Yeah, you may not know all the ins and outs as far as where to go, but at least you have, if we're talking about, for example, buried treasure. Okay, there was, you know, treasure that was sunken, or there's a treasure that's buried, you know, maybe within this particular parsec of land. So we just kind of have to get some more information and details. Well, that's really what they had under the Old Testament. And John's describing that here. With this woman and the light. And as you begin to think about the woman, you know, the system of religion that finally brings forth the child, and that child, of course, would be a reference to Christ. The imagery is very, very powerful. Can't really appreciate this, I guess, from a guy's standpoint, but you think about a lady. even with the easiest of pregnancies. You think there's still some difficulties? 9 months, you're going to have some bad days. All right, as you think about God's plan to redeem man, it's compared to a pregnant woman. You think as that plan starts really before eternity, but as it begins to move through time, you think there are some painful times? Think there are some difficulties, some obstacles? Old Testament is full of them. You have Israel's unfaithfulness. You've got, you know, good people going bad. You've got all kinds of crazy things. So you've got things like Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. You've got Moses, law, all kinds of interesting things that, as I said, John pictures here as a woman being pregnant. And then finally the time comes for who to be delivered. For God so loved the world that he gave. You think we could use the word sent? He sent his only begotten son. It's finally time for that Old Testament system of religion to give birth, if you will, to the Messiah. Now this lines up real well with the 12 stars at the end of the verse. Do you remember what we said about the number 12? It's a number for organized religion. Very good. All right, so we've got the 12 apostles under the New Testament, and with the Old Testament, which is what we're emphasizing right now, we've got the 12 tribes of Israel. So these 12 stars. One more way of telling us that John's talking about all the stuff that was used during the Old Testament system. Now, let's pick up some additional references. I want to probably have two readers for this. 2 Corinthians 3, verse 7, Steve, and Romans 2, 17 to 20, and then we'll also ask you to pick up the first two verses in Romans 3. Romans 2, 17 to 20, all right, that's going to be Dolores. And then after those verses, we'll pick up the third chapter, verses 1 and 2. Steve, that was you, yeah. 2 Corinthians 3, verse 7.
But if the ministry of death written and engraved on stones was glorious, so that the children of Israel could not look steadily at the face of Moses because of the glory of his countenance, which glory was passing away.
Okay, Paul talks about the information that was written on stones. What would that have been? All right, Ten Commandments, the Old Testament era. Does he say that there was glory associated with that?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, as you think about light and splendor and glory, it was there. Not as glorious as the New Testament. And Paul said it's passing away. The time for that has ceased. But still, it was, in many respects, a glorious system. Anybody ever seen some of the pictures of the Ark, the high priest, especially if you've seen that in color? I mean, it's pretty spectacular. You go back and you see. Again, it was a physical kind of thing, but it really was pretty impressive. All right, Dolores, let's start with Romans 2, verses 17 to 20.
Now you, if you call yourself a Jew, if you rely on the law and break back your relationship to God, if you know his will and approve of what is superior because you are instructed by the law, if you're convinced that you are a guide for the blind, a light for those who are in the dark, an instructor of the foolish, a teacher of infants, because you have in the law the embodiment of knowledge and truth.
Okay. Now think about this. Paul is describing the Jews who had the Old Testament information. And he says, you feel like you are a light, a guide. The people who are in a state of spiritual ignorance, you feel like you've got the right information for them. Well, that lines up real well with what we find in Revelation 12. There is this light, the sun, the moon, and the Old Testament did give people, as I said, some measure of light. It was a glorious system in many respects. Doesn't compare, can't hold a candle to what we have in the New Testament, but still, it did exactly what John is describing. And then, next chapter, if you would, Romans 3, 1 and 2. Dolores?
3, 1 and 2.
Uh-huh.
Sorry.
That's okay. You've got the words of God. You have some spiritual insight and light. Yeah, not nearly as great as we said with the New Testament, but still they had it. So as John uses the word sun and light, as I said, that's a way to consistently interpret what we have here. Now, a little later in the chapter of Revelation 12, verses 13 through 17, John is once again going to talk about this woman. But things have changed. Woman gets pregnant. Should be 9 months later. What happens? She's no longer pregnant. She has delivered her child. All right? If we're right in understanding this woman, this pregnant woman, as describing that Old Testament era that that led up to Christ, Christianity, the gospel, and so forth. This woman is pregnant in the sense that all this stuff is being prepared. When she gives birth, will things change? Yes, now the child is in the world. Now she's no longer pregnant. Bearing that in mind, what you'll see as I continue to sift through the chapter with you is that John uses this same image. He uses the image of a woman to describe religion. But now, since the woman has given birth, we're no longer talking about the Old Testament. Now he talks about the woman from the sense or the standpoint of the New Testament. So, logically, you'll see, I think this in verses 5 and 6. We'll skip down there for just a second. And she was delivered of a son, a man-child who is to rule all the nations with a rod of iron. And her child was caught up unto God in his throne. And the woman, now she's fleeing in the wilderness. A reference to the church and Satan's persecution. All right, a couple of the things, and then we'll see if there's anything else that you want to say. When we think about the New Testament, do we find the church being presented in feminine imagery? All right, Ephesians 5, 22 to 31, Paul talks about the church and compares it to a husband and wife. And then I think it's in verse 32, he says, the mystery is great. But I'm speaking about Christ and the church. So very definitely some information there. That's a well-known verse. You may also remember in Romans 7, verses 1 through 4, where Paul says, he gives an illustration of a woman that's married to a man. And he says, in this situation, everything is fine. But when that man dies, she's free to be married to, all right, another guy. And he said, if she's married to the first guy, and before that relationship ends, she goes out and gets involved with the second guy, she's guilty of adultery. So you've got to get rid of the first guy, if you will, before you can be joined to a second. And Paul says, you've been made dead to something. You're like a woman who was married to a guy in the sense of the Old Testament law. And he says, now that that relationship has ceased, the woman's given birth. You're joined, you're married to a new law. You're married to Christ. So Ephesians 5, there you have it. Also in Revelation chapter 21, we'll see that the church is compared to a bride, the wife of the Lamb. So even John is going to use this feminine imagery a little bit later towards the end of the book. This is also in contrast to some information that we're going to see a little later. You remember the great someone in Revelation 17 begins with an H. All right, we've got the great whore, we've got the great harlot, and she's going to stand in contrast to the bride, the bride of Christ. So you've got, you know, two vastly different groups of people. Anything you want to add or ask before we pick up with Revelation 12:2?
So does the first part of this talk about Israel waiting for the coming?
I think you've got all these things in the Old Testament that are leading up to Jesus. That first part of God's plan. You know, you go back there in the garden, Satan, Adam and Eve, the promise in Genesis 3 and so forth, and then you get forward a little bit. Genesis 12 talks about the promises to Abraham and then moves down to Isaac. You've got Jacob, you've got God's people in Egypt. And then finally, you've got the deliverance, you've got Moses' law, you've got God's people going into captivity, coming out of captivity, the 400-year silent period, and just all of these various events compared to this pregnant woman.
So it's covering the steps.
Yes, I mean, it's just kind of like a summary of thousands of years of biblical history. So John covers a lot. In fact, we're going to see in verse 5, and this is tipping my hand a little bit, but if you think about this, verse 5, she was delivered of her son, a man-child, who is to rule the nations with a rod of iron, and the child was caught up unto God unto his throne. Now think about this. She was delivered of her child. For a woman to give birth, what has to happen? She's got to get pregnant, right? So you've got all these steps that lead up to the birth time. All that stuff under the Old Testament. Then she gives birth. You've got the New Testament. And then John says, he's caught up where? To God. What would that refer to? If we're talking about Christ and Christianity. Was he caught up? The ascension? Resurrection, right? So you think about verse 5. It just kind of sweeps all that together in a single verse. All the things that led up to Jesus coming into the world. His coming. And then finally his ascension. So it is kind of a mind-boggling chapter as far as all the stuff that John squeezes in here. And I mean, he only uses, what do we have? 17 verses. And I mean, it's a power-packed chapter. Anybody else? Okay, let's pick up then with the information in verse 2. We're going to see this build as we go forth, and that's why I tried to kind of lay some things out in the introductory notes. And she was with child, and she crieth out, travailing in birth, and the pain to be delivered. It was said a little bit ago that as we think about a woman's pregnancy, there are a lot of twists and turns, and not all of those are pleasant, and that was also true for God's plan. When we start with the book of Genesis, and we start moving all the way to the book of Matthew, we find all kinds of interesting things happening with God's plan to fulfill people. We've got all kinds of obstacles. It looked like at various times God's plan was going to be met with defeat from various men, women. There were sometimes nations that opposed God's people. Certainly we've got the devil being involved. Israel, when we think about that nation, it was God's chosen people. We're going to talk about that some tonight in the evening lesson. And yet, as you look at Israel, were there times when they were unfaithful, rebellious? Didn't take very long. I mean, they barely get out of the Exodus, and they're already having some difficulties. So deity, if you will, had a lot of pains to bring Jesus into the world. But Paul says in Galatians 4:4, when the fullness of time came. You know, the time comes when it's right for a woman to deliver her child. Sometimes it comes a little earlier than they might like. But still, the fullness of time comes for them, and they do bring forth a child. Paul said the same thing was true for Christ. When the time was right, when the time was ripe, God's plan was fully executed. And now, if you think about this, and you go back a little bit to Revelation 11, verse 17, notice the connection saying, we give thanks, or we give thee thanks, O Lord, God the Almighty. You are, you were, because you've taken your great power and you did reign. You've been successful. This plan that John talks about in Revelation 12 was successfully executed, so God is worthy of honor and praise. Now, beginning with the next verse, Revelation 12, verse 3, John's going to introduce a great red dragon. This, of course, would be a reference to Satan, and he's pictured as having some success among his people. Then, in Revelation 13, we're going to find some information about a beast coming out of the sea. That's going to be another power that is pictured as having some success as far as warfare against God's people. And then in Revelation 16:13, we're going to read about another creature, a false prophet. And then John's going to, as he continues to develop these ideas, to say that all of these things have failed. Just as Satan failed to undo God's plan to redeem man, so these additional forces that he talks about are also going to be unsuccessful. All right, let's move then to verse 3. We're going to say more about this, and you may have some additional input as we get a little further into the chapter. And there was seen another sign in heaven, and behold, a great red dragon, having seven heads and ten horns, and upon his heads seven diadems. In that first verse, John said, I've already got a great sign to tell you about. And when we think about what we've talked about, it certainly was very, very great. God had this plan to bring Jesus into the world, use things like Moses' law, and it really was a fantastic thing. Now John says he saw something else. And here in this second image, what's he described? There was a great red dragon. And how many heads does it have? It's got seven heads. And how many diadems? How many diadems? How many crowns? All right. We've got ten. Let's see. Let me get that right. Seven diadems, don't we? Okay. Yeah. Ten horns. I had to get my sevens and my tens right. Thank you. If we move down a little bit to verse 9, we are specifically told what this creature was. And the great dragon was cast down, the old serpent, he that's called the devil. So when we identify this creature back here in verse 3 with the information in verse 9, we can know for sure that we are dealing with Satan. We are going to see as we pick up with some information a little bit later in Revelation 13 and also Revelation 17, some information about this symbolism. But I do want to kind of lay some foundation for that right now. In the first part of the verse, John says, we've got this dragon. He's got seven heads. Now, some have looked at this. I guess I'm not completely on board with this, but it does, I think, bear mentioning. Some have looked at this information and they've said, okay, you know, as you look at world history up to this point, we've had seven major world powers. And world, I'm using that, I mean, we would think of America now as a world power, but I'm thinking about world power in the sense that it looked like these groups really controlled everything. Their power was literally worldwide. Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome, and then you've got the Holy Roman Empire about 800 AD. And some have said, well, these seven heads are a reference to these powers. That could be the case. More likely, though, I think when we see that number 7 to retain consistency in the book of Revelation, what's that number associated with? Completeness, power, fullness. All right, so let's take that information and let's join it with the idea of a head. Now, what would be, if we're talking about, you know, heads of things, what comes to mind? Oh, all right, government. We're talking about civil authority. So if you've got 7 heads and you've got 7 crowns, which one sounds like, or was it? Yeah, it's the 10 horns. Got to keep that in mind. You're kind of descending. You've got the heads, you've got the crowns, and then you've got the horns. So when you think about the 7 heads, you would be dealing with power on what kind of scale? Gave you the answer just a minute ago. The head of something. Can you go any higher than the head? That's it. So when we think about a sense of a government that's the head of the world, what are we thinking about? Well, no, because you've got a president just of a country. But if you're thinking about a head, literally, over all the world. All right, it'd be like the Roman Empire. You go back to the first century, and it seems like everything is controlled by Rome. Now, today in America, we've got the ability to influence a lot of people throughout the world, but we don't have control over a lot of nations. So America wouldn't be like a head. It would be more like a crown, some country that has a great deal of power. And then you, of course, would have lesser officials and so forth. There is, I think, a passage here in Revelation 17, verse 12, which is going to help us a little bit. Somebody want to read that for us? 17:12. There it is. All right. 10 horns represent 10 kings. So this additional passage is one of the things that as we look at the horns, as we look at the crowns, as we look at the heads, we're dealing with civil authority. And as I said, it's kind of in descending order. He starts with the heads first. Countries that have really had worldwide power, or we might say the empires that have really exercised worldwide power, and then you begin to break it down a little bit. So number 7 could be literal, but I'm more inclined to think that it's a spiritual way of saying that there will be sufficient numbers of empires throughout time, especially the Christian era, where Satan is going to be able to draw from, he's going to be supported by these empires to do what? Persecute God's people. Did he do it with Egypt? Yeah. Did he do it with Assyria? Did he do it with the Medes and Persians? Yeah. As you go back and you begin to look at history, God's people did not fare very well under the kinds of powers that we are dealing with. And, you know, that's not surprising. In 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 4, Paul said that Satan is the god of this world. So there are obviously some times where things have gone better for God's people than at other times, but he's very, very good at what he does. And John, remember that we're dealing with information that happened after the cross. So Satan has been defeated in the sense that he has lost a lot of his power, but he still has sufficient authority to get people, even the majority of people, on his side. I think it's significant that as John describes him, let's go back there and reread what we said. And there was seen another sign in heaven, behold, how Satan described a great dragon. So as you look at that word, it tells me that he's not toothless. He's still very, very powerful. And his power is restricted from the sense we've compared him in previous classes to a chained dog. You know, if that chain is 6 foot and you are 7 feet away, you're probably going to be in pretty good shape. But you get inside that 6 foot area that's his domain, he'll tear you up. Because you put yourself within his reach. And it's a good way to, I think, illustrate Satan today. Now, we'll say a little bit more about this as we continue through the text, but let's also make another point. Satan is not only described with the word great, what else is said about him? He's a dragon. And anything else said about him? He's red. Well, you think Satan's a literal dragon? Big fire-breathing creature we see on TV? Probably not. He's a spiritual creature. Well, if we would reject the idea that he's a literal dragon, we probably also need to reject the idea that he is red. I don't know that we would normally associate a color with Satan. I mean, green or blue or purple. But, and I mentioned to Stan the other day, I said, maybe this is where people have gotten the idea that Satan's in a red suit. If it is, it would not be a good passage. When we think about the color red, what do we associate with as far as that color? All right, blood, I think, is the first thing that would pop to my mind, And then, well, let's hold on to that. You're right, but I was going to give you a cross-reference. Revelation 16, I think it's verse 6. For they poured out the blood of saints and prophets. They poured it out. And blood hast thou given them to drink. They are worthy. As John talks about some of the opponents, the blood of God's people was literally poured out. Well, when we think about somebody that's involved in massive bloodshed, red comes to mind. So Satan, remember John 8? Jesus said Satan is a... and a murderer. Not always literally, but spiritually, what he does. And then the other answer that came from sailors?
Anger.
You know, you see the face getting red. As you look down in the chapter just a little bit, look at verse 17. And the dragon, a reference to Satan, waxed wroth with the woman, with God's people, the saints, the church. He was angry with God's people and went away to do what? Make war with God's people. And when you find somebody that once is so angry they're going to go out and make war, you find you have a person who's very, very angry. So this color red seems to be a good passage to describe Satan's anger and also the fact that he is a bloodthirsty creature. He's vicious. He wants to inflict as much pain and suffering on people as he possibly can. He's not a cute little guy with a pitchfork and sitting around a little red suit. That would be an interesting association. Whether or not that's joined with what John says here, we don't know. But when we think about his fate, Jesus did talk about hell in those kinds of terms. So whatever his interest or lack of in fire is right now, he's going to get his fill of it for eternity. There's no doubt about that. Anybody else, based on what we've said so far? Betty?
King James Version does say fiery red.
Huh. Well, I'm going to have to take a look at that. I'll have to go and look at the word and see if it's... I don't know if there's more than one color for red in the Greek New Testament or not, but maybe there is. It might be a special word, or maybe it's just the word red. But I'll check that out. Thank you. Anybody else, based on what we've said so far? Stan?
You have to be careful going back to the turn 7. If I understood what you're saying correctly, being seven literal
yes.
kingdoms, et cetera, because that doesn't allow for...
Correct. And that's why I say, I think you can really be on some shaky ground there. In fact, John's going to talk about an eighth organization later in the book, which would really kind of throw a monkey wrench into that. So, as I said, my preference is to go ahead and really understand that from the spiritual standpoint. The seven means completeness, fullness. Satan has had plenty of help through various powers that really have worldwide dominion. And we've got some good examples of that as far as history. But, there's no doubt that he's gotten help from those. But to actually go down and say it's exactly this number, there's probably where you're going to find, you're on thin ice at that point. But at least come away with that main thought. Anybody else? Okay, let's pick up with some information in verse 4 as well. We may not have the best breaking point today, but we'll go as far as we can. And his tail. Think the devil has a literal tail? No. So just as we would not think of him as a literal dragon, we would not think of him as literally being red. He also doesn't have a literal tail. So, once again, figurative information in verse 4. His tail draws the third part of the stars of heaven, and did cast them to the earth. And the dragon standeth there before the woman that is about to be delivered, that when she is delivered, he may devour her child. We talked about the figurative language, the fact that the devil has no literal tail. And now, based on that, let's make one additional point. We can't number the stars. People have tried, and I mean, God says you're not going to be able to do that. But, we know that it's well over a sextillion as far as the number of stars out there. So when John says the devil, grabbed those stars and brought them down, Literal? No. It's got to be a symbolic way of describing some truth. And one of the things I think that is expressed there would be Satan's power. He did have, especially before you know, Jesus came to the world, established his church and so forth, he did have a great deal of power. And here, since we're talking about this woman, pregnant woman, refers to the things that were leading up to Christ, if he's trying to, you know, bring down a third of the stars of heaven, what's that saying about his efforts to stop the institution of the gospel, creation of Christianity? He tried very hard. I mean, might be too much to say he was straining himself, but he was doing everything that he could because he apparently had some understanding. I mean, if people had some knowledge of what God was going to do, Genesis 3, Isaiah 9, Satan would have apparently had at least that much knowledge and maybe much more. So for him, getting Jesus into the world, we also see that, I think, with the life of Christ, I would be inclined to say that he worked through Herod in trying to destroy Jesus. We know with the temptations, you know, you've got the 40 days that he's hammering Jesus. Why go to all that trouble if you don't know that, hey, this guy is going to be really my undoing as far as trying to keep people in sin? So Satan is pulling out all the stops. And John, as I said, with this brief imagery, sums up all of this information. Now, at this point, the baby has not yet been delivered. Jesus has not actually come into the world. Now, if you think about what we're saying as far as these stars, we've already given in some previous classes some information that helps us understand what's going on here. John, in previous passages, has talked about the fourth part of man, and he's also talked about the third part of man. Anybody remember from some of those preceding discussions what the fourth part of man refers to? Man's
physical
body. And then we said the third part of man refers to the spiritual part. Well, based on what we've said, what will we expect as far as which figure? The fourth part, man's physical body, or the third part? We would be thinking in terms of the third part because we're dealing with man's spiritual part, with his soul. So when John says the devil tried to cast down the third part of the stars, it's another way of saying, hey, this deals with the spiritual component of humanity. We've got some information back in Revelation 6, verses 12 through 17, to describe how falling stars were an image in the Old Testament to overthrow civil government. But here, the imagery is somewhat different. We've got stars in heaven instead of earthly powers. I think there are a couple of Old Testament passages that will help us just a little bit here. Let's see if we can get somebody to go back to Genesis. Genesis 26, verse 4. Okay.
Because it mentions, you know, three times, like in heaven, in heaven, in heaven. Is that referred to? I'm taking this as Satan against God, right?
There's a spiritual conflict. I'm going to go that far with it right
okay.
now. But let's pick up the Old Testament. Let's pick up the Old Testament references and kind of see if this helps us a bit. Let's go back to Genesis 26:4 for our first reading. That's going to be Harvey, and then somebody in the next book, Exodus 32, verse 13. That reference is going to be read by Scott. Okay, Harvey, Genesis 26, verse 4.
I will make thy seed to multiply the stars of heaven, and will give unto thy seed all these countries, and in thy seed shall all nations of the earth be blessed.
Okay. Stars of heaven. Who's being described here with this wording? I'm going to make them as the stars of heaven. We're talking about descendants. All right, we're talking about the posterity. And when you think that these folks are going to be good folks or bad folks, well, they should be good folks. Exodus 32, verse 13.
Remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, your servants, to whom you swore by your own self, and said to them, I will multiply your offspring as the stars of heaven. And all this land that I have promised, I will give your offspring, and they shall inherit it forever.
Okay, stars of heaven, Genesis 26, Exodus 32. And who were these stars? Who did they become?
The offspring.
Well, the Hebrews, didn't they? The nation of Israel. They were God's people, weren't they? You know, you're going to be the stars of heaven. And now God says, through John over here, we're going to take the stars of heaven, the same wording, and we're going to try to do what with them? We're going to try to bring them down. And he says, how many of those? The third part, the spiritual part. So the spiritual part of the righteous. Satan was trying to destroy those. So not information literally about the stars, not, you know, grabbing the various constellations and so forth, but once again a reference to Satan trying to oppose God's people. And, you know, we've got a lot of them. So before Jesus comes to the earth, you've got Satan trying to destroy the spiritual part of people. You know, he didn't want to wait until the cross came to go ahead and inflict damage on people. And after Jesus came to the earth, as we're going to see from the rest of Revelation chapter 12, things really seem to pick up speed. Satan, you can imagine that the restrictions that he had prior to the cross, I mean, he apparently wanted to work unhindered in any possible way. But when he can kind of see, hey, Jesus is coming down the pike, you know, it's like people today, they can see that some bad news is on the horizon. They weren't real comfortable, but now you see what's coming. And it's almost panic time. And this is really the image that we get with Satan. As we start putting this together, I think one of the things that really fascinates me is that today a lot of people are not very watchful when it comes to spiritual things. This is one of the things that Jesus said, watch. The picture that we're beginning to develop of Satan, though, does it look like he was a watchful creature? Looks like he's kind of, you know, he's trying to inflict as much damage as he can to pull the third part of the stars down before, you know, Jesus comes. Do as much damage as he can, and at the same time, he's got his eye on the ball. And he's pictured here as watching this woman. And not only watching her, but when it comes time to deliver the baby, what's he want to do? Kill her! Or, well, maybe kill her, but at least kill Jesus. Devour this particular woman. So, that would have been a great coup for him to go ahead and destroy the Lord, but that simply didn't happen.